From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In his new film, Sicko, Michael Moore creates a picture of a health insurance system that is sick and inadequate in responding to people who are sick. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about some of the questions raised in the movie with an expert on healthcare policy and politics, Jonathan Oberlander. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Mosaic box set of recordings by the tenor saxophonist Chu Berry. In the 30s, he backed Billie Holiday and Mildred Bailey and played in Fletcher Henderson's and Cab Calloway's bands. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
There are nearly 50 million Americans with no health insurance. They pray every day they don't get sick, because 18,000 of them will die this year simply because they're uninsured. But this movie isn't about them. It's about the 250 million of you who have health insurance. Those of you who are living the American dream.
Michael Moore's film Sicko raises a lot of questions about the quality of Americans' health insurance and compares our system to countries like Canada, England, and France, where everyone is insured and health care is free. So we thought we'd pose some of the questions raised in the film to an expert on health care policy and politics. My guest is Jonathan Oberlander. He's an associate professor of social medicine and health policy and administration at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's also the author of the book, The Political Life of Medicare. Here's another clip from Sicko, which is filled with examples of people who have health insurance but still have problems getting covered for illnesses and medical emergencies.
Laura Burnham was in a 45-mile-an-hour head-on collision that knocked her out cold. Paramedics got her out of the car and into an ambulance for a trip to the hospital.
I get a bill from my insurance company telling me that the ambulance ride was not going to be paid for because it wasn't pre-approved. I don't know exactly when I was supposed to pre-approve it, you know, like after I gained consciousness in the car, before I got in the ambulance, or I should have grabbed my cell phone off of the street and called while I was in the ambulance, or, I mean, it was just crazy.
Jonathan Oberlander, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with a short review of Sicko. What did you think of the film?
He gets a lot right about the American healthcare system and really shows how the system doesn't work. He cuts a few corners and leaves a few things out, which admittedly are hard to get in a two-hour format.
Now, Michael Moore presents the healthcare systems of France, England, and Canada as better alternatives because everyone in those three countries gets the healthcare they need for free. Which of those countries have you studied most carefully?
Canada.
So let's focus on Canada. Describe how that system works.
Canada is what's called a single-payer system, and it's really similar philosophically to American Medicare. Physicians are still private in Canada. They're by and large not government employees. Many of the hospitals are non-for-profit. And the difference is, instead of having lots of different private insurers, you just have one public insurer in each Canadian province, just like we have one government program for the elderly in the United States. And Canadians get that insurance regardless of whether they're working or not working or where they live in Canada.
So how is that system paid for?
Well, the Canadians pay for it primarily through taxes. What's interesting about Canada compared to the U.S. is they really don't rely on a lot of patient cost sharing or a lot of deductibles. In fact, that is outlawed in the Canadian provinces. So this is a tax-based system. And as someone says in the movie, really the philosophy is from each according to their own means, what they can afford to pay, and then they take out of the system in terms of medical benefits according to their needs.
So it's a progressive tax, but you get whatever health care you need, regardless of what tax you've paid.
Within limits. And one of the things that's not really part of the movie is that there are trade-offs in Canada and in other countries. And the Canadians do set limits on what they spend for healthcare. And while they have a terrific system, they've got their own problems.
What are some of those problems? Let's start with the limits. What are the limits that are set?
Well, they budget. And that's what most other countries do when they decide how much to spend on healthcare. This is, you know, we talk about the American system and we spend $2 trillion a year, which is most in the world by a long shot. And if you ask how do countries like Canada control what they spend, it's not very complicated. They set budgetary limits on how much they're going to pay for hospitals. They set limits on what they're going to pay physicians. And they have a fee schedule similar to what we use in Medicare, but binding across all physicians in Canada. They also limit the diffusion of medical technologies. So while primary care, for instance, is easily accessible in Canada, if you want to get an MRI, which is readily available in the United States because we have MRIs all over the place, they have far fewer MRIs in Canada. And there are some other high-tech procedures that they do less of than we do, and that creates queues or wait lists.
What about waits for surgery or medical procedures or even office visits with specialists? Is that a problem?
It really varies. In terms of primary care, there is not much of a problem there, as far as I know, with waiting. And in fact, they have a much greater proportion of primary care doctors than we do in the U.S. So there are more doctors for you to see. For a lot of surgeries, there are urgent surgeries, there would not be a wait in Canada. But there are waits for things like hip replacements. They're not as bad as some of the waits in the United Kingdom. And we also always have to be careful in the U.S. One of the values, I think, of the movie is that we have this stigma of socialized medicine. And Michael Moore tries to go beyond that. And one of the arguments you hear is we can't move to universal coverage because those countries ration. And the truth of the matter is the United States rations in medical care, too. We ration according to your insurance status. We don't like to think we ration, and so we pretend that we don't ration. But for the 45 million Americans who don't have health insurance, they're really experiencing a form of rationing that is much more severe than any Canadian ever would.
Are there forms of rationing within a lot of HMOs, too?
Absolutely. HMOs in the last three decades really have focused on controlling costs. And the sort of supposition of the modern HMO, which has a lot of merit to it, is that there's a lot of unnecessary medical care in the United States and a lot of services that are provided of very little value because doctors get paid according to fees for each service that they provide. So the more services they provide, the more fees. HMOs were really, in a way, created to fight against that, and they absolutely do set limits, and they have their own form of rationing.
Let's get back to Canada. You say that there are certain things you might have to wait in line for, like an MRI. If you're rich, can you get to the head of the line, or is there a way of getting special treatment?
In general, no. It's a very equitable system. Everybody is in the same boat. You're all in the same system. In reality, a fairly heavy percent of the Canadian population lives to the American border. So you could come across the border and get your MRI. And you hear stories of that. But when we look at the evidence about that, what we find is a very small percent of Canadians actually come over to the United States to get medical care. And of course, the reverse is true. We have Americans going to Canada to buy cheaper prescription drugs and also to Mexico.
What do Canadians complain about within their own healthcare system?
The Canadian healthcare system, which is also known as Medicare, is the most popular social institution in Canada. It is supported by all political parties. So the conflict that surrounds it is really over funding levels. And there have been battles between Ottawa and the provinces, much like our battles over Medicaid, about who should pay for what. I would say in terms of patients, there have been complaints in the last 15 years that some of the queues have gotten longer and some of them aren't managed as well as they could be. But in terms of general support for the foundation principles of the Canadian system, it's still very strong and a very popular program.
What are some of the advantages of healthcare not being a political issue? It's such a political issue here.
Well, I wouldn't say it's not a political issue. I would say it's a political issue in a different way, in the sense that you have broad consensus that healthcare is a right and that healthcare should cover everyone. Everyone should have health insurance. Once you agree on those principles, there's plenty of room for disagreement on how you're going to fund it and on how you're going to deal with things like wait lists and other reforms to the system. In the United States, we have never gotten to that point of recognizing that healthcare is a right. We recognize it for some populations, such as the elderly, but we don't recognize it for everybody.
Are there aspects of the Canadian healthcare system where healthcare is free and available to everyone that you think could transfer to the United States?
Well, in a sense, we already have transferred some of the lessons within our own Medicare program. And if you look at the American Medicare program, it is a universal program for that population, the elderly, folks on end-stage renal dialysis, and the disabled. And the Medicare program has very low administrative costs, just like the Canadian healthcare system, and really does a lot of things well. So we have transferred some of those lessons here. The question is, how do you transfer them to the population as a whole? And I think Michael Moore would like to see a single-payer Canadian-style system for the entire country. And that's a strategy that reformers have been pursuing for 35 years in the United States, and it hasn't gone anywhere. And I wouldn't hold my breath.
Why not?
The political barriers to it are very strong. I said before that we spend $2 trillion a year on healthcare. All that money that we spend on healthcare is income to insurance companies and providers, the pharmaceutical industry, and so on. They literally profit from the status quo, and they're deeply invested in keeping the status quo. And as the Clintons found out in the early 1990s, it's really hard to move the status quo in the United States. And so the idea that we could displace private health insurance, which, you know, insures over 160 million Americans, I think really politically is just a very tough fit for this country.
How do the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry exert their influence over Congress?
I think one of the more amusing and also poignant scenes in the movie is where different members of Congress are walking into a room and Michael Moore puts price tags over their heads. And the fact of the matter is the way we finance elections in this country allows the pharmaceutical industry, the health insurance industry, and a whole lot of other healthcare interests to fund campaigns. And they can put a lot of money in those campaigns and give a lot of money to political parties. And once you've given that money, the question is, what are they buying for that money? And I think it's safe to assume that in many cases, they are buying a sense of political obligation and a sense of members of Congress who take that money that they're not going to rock the boat. They're not going to upset the status quo. And I really do believe that that was at work during the Medicare Drug Act, which in many ways was very favorable to the industry. And the industry was working hand in glove with Congress on it.
What about the AME? Like, what's their interest in the future of health insurance in the United States, and what's their preference?
The AME is an interesting story because for most of the 20th century, organized medicine was the number one obstacle to national health insurance. They were the most prominent interest group that was fighting against it. And their argument was you would go to what they called socialized medicine, which is really a term that doesn't mean anything, but has a lot of stigma with it. And you would threaten patients' quality of care and physicians' autonomy and their income. And they organized and fought against everything from prenatal care and medical care for children to the Medicare, original Medicare legislation in 1965, to national health insurance. And what has happened to the AMA in the last few decades is that organized medicine is no longer very organized. And the AMA only covers, I believe, around 40% of physicians in terms of its membership. And a lot of doctors are more active in their specialty society, be it the family physicians or the American College of Surgeons and so forth. And the result is the AMA really doesn't speak for all or even most of American physicians anymore. If you look at what they're doing right now, they have recently joined a coalition that's advocating for expanded coverage. But it's really a sort of incremental agenda. And one gets the sense that they are much more deeply involved in fights over medical malpractice and fights over what Medicare is paying physicians than they are in advocating for the uninsured. If they would advocate for the uninsured with the same intensity that they advocate for medical malpractice reform, we might actually be able to break the impasse.
My guest is Jonathan Oberlander. He's an associate professor of social medicine and health policy and administration at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Oberlander. He's an associate professor of social medicine and health policy and administration at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. We're talking about the American health insurance system and how it compares with other countries, and we're using the Michael Moore movie Sicko as a kind of jumping off point. We've expressed skepticism that a single-payer plan like the plan in Canada would ever really happen in the United States anytime in the near future because of the politics of our system. You know, the insurance lobby, the pharmaceutical lobby. Is there a system that from another country that you think would apply here and, you know, would be easier to, you know, politically activate?
Well, no country copies another country's healthcare system exactly. And every country has their own history of how their healthcare system has developed, which really impacts what kind of reform is feasible. I don't know if there are plans for a sequel, you know, a Sicko 2 coming out in a few years. But if Michael Moore was going to do Sicko 2, I would send him to Germany and I'd send him to Australia. And the reason I would send him to those countries is those countries do use private health insurance in their universal coverage systems. And I think if we're really going to consider how to get universal coverage in the United States, we probably are going to continue with our mixed system that has a role for public insurance and private insurance. Now, it's true that in a place like Germany, the kind of private insurance they have is very different than ours. It's nonprofit. It's highly regulated. They can't charge sick people more. And those are the kind of reforms that President Clinton wanted back in 1993. And they're exactly the kind of reforms that we would have to have if we were going to use that kind of system. But I think those mixed models that use public insurance and private insurance are much more feasible politically in the United States. They're not easy by any stretch of the imagination, but I think they're a better fit.
So in Germany, there's private insurance, but it's like nonprofit insurance. Would you explain like what that type of insurance is like?
Sure. They have, and you know, it tells you something that it's very hard for Americans to understand this because we really don't have it anymore. But in Germany, they have a system that is based on what's called sickness funds. And these are nonprofit insurance companies that are heavily regulated by the government, and they're employer-based. So like the United States, it is employment-based insurance, but instead of having lots of different for-profit insurance companies, as we do, that aren't well-regulated, they have non-for-profit insurance companies that are heavily regulated and that all play by one set of rules.
But one of the problems we have in the United States is that if you're unemployed or if you work part-time or if you're freelance, you don't get the benefit of employer health benefits. So how do they deal with that in Germany?
In Germany and in other countries that have employer-based universal coverage, the government would buy you into the system. The fact in the United States that when you lose your job, you lose your health insurance and can become uninsured, that is uniquely American.
Describe the Australian system.
The Australian system is a hybrid system, and they have both public and private insurance. And so for Australians who want to get it, they're able to purchase private insurance, and that can get them, for instance, a different room in the hospital and so forth. And I think that's a really interesting example for the United States because personally, while it might be great and equitable to have everybody in the same system, if we make sure that the government program is a good quality program, I'm not troubled at all by the fact that some people would have access to private insurance. And Australia has much more of a prominent role for private insurance than Canada or than Great Britain.
So with more money, you could get better care, but everybody is assured of getting adequate care.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a model for the United States that would work.
In countries like England, France, and Canada that have where everybody's insured and it's everybody's in the same system, how much money do they save on administrative costs when you think of the amount of money Americans are paying within their health insurance for administrative costs? It's pretty high.
It's staggering. One study found that the United States spends about 30% of all healthcare spending on administrative costs, so 30% of $2 trillion. In Canada, it was about 17%. And one of the reasons that it's so much cheaper in Canada is if you look at SICKO and you see the amount of time that patients spend fighting with their insurance companies on what they're going to cover, and the amount of time and effort that insurance companies spend on figuring out how much they're going to charge people, figuring out how sick they are, figuring out whether they're going to insure them at all. None of that happens in countries like Canada. So in other words, because we have a for-profit system that is fragmented, it has very high marketing costs, very high costs for sales, and a lot of costs associated with what's called medical underwriting, figuring out how sick people are. And we really waste a lot of money on that function instead of spending it on medical care.
So if we had a single-payer system, we'd be saving a lot of money just from eliminating a lot of the bureaucracy.
There's no question, and not even a single-payer system. If we had a multi-payer system like Germany, where you had regulated private insurance, where everybody plays by the same rules, but insurance companies have to accept somebody regardless of how sick they are, we would save a lot of money. And I think what's interesting in this regard is earlier this year, the McKinsey Institute, which is a consultant in healthcare, and this is not Michael Moore, this is not MoveOn.org, this is a high-powered corporation. They did a fascinating report looking at just this question about why is American medical care so much more expensive than other countries. And what that report found is it's not because our quality of care is better. It's not because we're getting better value for our money. It's because, in large part, we have very high administrative costs due to medical underwriting and profits, and because we pay our medical providers more.
Jonathan Oberlander is an associate professor of social medicine and health policy and administration at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's also the author of The Political Life of Medicare. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement, online at TIAACREF.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new box set of recordings by tenor saxophonist Chu Berry. He played with Fletcher Henderson's and Cab Calloway's bands and backed Mildred Bailey and Billie Holiday. And we continue our interview on health insurance with John Oberlander.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Michael Moore's film Sicko raises a lot of questions about the American system of health insurance and compares us to countries like Canada, France, and England, where everyone is insured and health care is free. We're talking about some of the issues raised in the film with Jonathan Oberlander, an expert on health policy and politics. He's an associate professor of social medicine and health policy and administration at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. A lot of people are very critical of HMOs. Sicko is pretty critical of HMOs. Did HMOs have a more idealistic philosophy when they started?
They really started out as a liberal idea in the 1930s and 1940s. And in conventional American medical care, you would get your insurance and go to any doctor you wanted and any hospital you wanted. But it really wasn't very organized, and it really wasn't coordinated. And physicians were paid on a fee-for-service basis. And the idea behind the early HMOs in the 1930s and 1940s, they were called prepaid group practice plans, is they would integrate medical care in one organization that would provide your insurance. In other words, they would finance your medical care, but they would also arrange the delivery. So the classic HMO, like Kaiser Permanente, they would own their own hospitals and they would have their own doctors. So when you went to the doctor, you would see a Kaiser physician and just a Kaiser physician. And the goal of these prepaid group practices in the 1930s and 40s was really to emphasize prevention, to give more comprehensive medical care, better integrated medical care, and have physicians on salary, so you would remove some of the inflationary incentives of fee-for-service.
And would you say something went wrong along the way?
Well, what you see in Sicko, and it really is accurate, in the 1970s, HMOs were reinvented, or prepaid group practices were renamed HMOs, and they were reinvented as a cost control mechanism. And since the 1970s, the HMO market has really taken off in the United States, particularly since the late 1980s, and it's really changed. It used to be dominated by nonprofit HMOs like Kaiser. After the 1970s, for-profit HMOs began accelerating, and they really dominate the market. I think that a lot of abuses that are documented in the movie, and a lot of your listeners will be familiar with HMOs, really came out of the for-profit HMO movement in the 1980s and 1990s. Having said that, HMOs have really flatlined. We're really almost beyond managed care now in the United States. And sometimes the movie left me with the impression that problems in the healthcare system started and ended with HMOs, and I think that's just not right.
What do you mean when you say HMOs have flatlined? I certainly know of a lot of HMOs and a lot of people in HMOs.
They still have a good share of the market, but enrollment in HMOs has declined over the last decade. And most Americans are now in a much weaker form of managed care, which is called a PPO. And a PPO really doesn't manage anything, and it doesn't coordinate anything, and doesn't have any of the emphasis on prevention or integration of care like a Kaiser Permanente. It's just an organization that contracts with physicians and hospitals to get a discounted rate. And that really is the form of managed care that is prevalent right now.
Are PPOs more expensive than HMOs?
On average, historically, they have been a little more expensive. And, you know, one of the questions that I think is worth asking, we beat back managed care. Managed care spread in the United States in the mid-1990s. We had a backlash against managed care led by physicians, led by patients who were dissatisfied with all the barriers that managed care was putting in their way. We really beat it back and got rid of a lot of the HMOs and got rid of a lot of the tightly managed care. What is the consequence? Well, one of the consequences is we have rapidly increasing medical costs again. And because we have rapidly increasing medical costs, more employers are dropping health insurance. So are some patients better off because we loosened managed care? Absolutely. Have a lot of people lost health insurance because we beat back managed care? That's probably true as well.
We know the employer-based health insurance system seems to be falling apart. It's too expensive for employers to deal with. So many employers are trying to go to cheaper benefits, which the employees are unhappy with, or they're cutting down their staff so that there's fewer people to pay insurance for. or they're relying more on freelancers or part-timers. Is there a movement of employers who are unhappy with what employer-based health insurance means now and who are trying to find an alternative?
If there's one thing that surprised me about Sicko in terms of not being there, it is really inattention to the employer perspective. As you say, the employer-based system is unraveling. You know, it wasn't long ago when 69% of American companies provided health insurance. We're down around 60% right now. And this is, healthcare is a moral issue. There's no doubt about that. But I think one of the lessons of the failure of health reform is that moral outrage only gets you so far. And I would have liked to have seen the movie frame it as an economic issue as well. Because for big American corporations, for small businesses, really for all of them, they're having a hard time paying this bill. And as a result, we have seen some pretty extraordinary events in the last year. We had Lee Scott, who is the CEO of Walmart, get up on a stage with Andy Stern, who is the head of the Service Employees Union. And together they announced a coalition that was going to advocate for universal coverage. Given Walmart's record in health benefits, that's pretty extraordinary. We've had Steve Bird out in California, who is the CEO of Safeway and who is a conservative Republican, and he is forming his own coalition of employers to advocate for universal coverage. And if you think about this historically, it's really, there was a short film, I think in the 1960s or 70s, called Bambi Meets Godzilla, where Bambi is sort of dancing around in the forest, and you see this huge foot stomp on Bambi, and that's the end of the movie. And that's like the health reform debate. And Bambi would be the labor unions and the liberals advocating for universal coverage. Godzilla would be the AMA and the insurance industry and businesses and conservatives. It's never been a very even fight. But if you were to move business from the side of opposition to support for universal coverage, what you would have, I think, is a political realignment in health reform. And if we get health reform in this country and universal coverage, I think in a way it's more likely to come from that direction.
My guest is Jonathan Oberlander. He's an associate professor of social medicine and health policy and administration at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Oberlander. He's an associate professor of social medicine and health policy and administration at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Now, there's something, there's like a new movement afoot that's called consumer-driven healthcare that's being proposed as an alternative. What is that?
Well, I think it's a badly named movement because it's certainly not being driven by consumers. Essentially, what it is referring to is the spreading of high deductible insurance policies. And the idea in consumer-driven health insurance is people will take these policies that have very high deductibles, could be $2,000, $3,000, $5,000, and you pair them with a health savings account, which is a tax-preferred account, similar in some ways to the IRA. And that really is the future of American healthcare, at least at the moment. It is the successor to managed care. In a lot of ways, I think it's much worse than managed care.
In what ways?
Managed care had a lot of flaws to it, but I think when it was done right, they were trying to coordinate care. They were trying to integrate care, at least the good HMOs. What consumer-driven healthcare is doing, and these high deductibles, is really just shifting the costs of medical care onto the backs of patients. And you notice that they've transformed the language of patients to the language of consumers. And really, folks who have serious illnesses and who are chronically ill can be hurt in these systems because in conventional insurance, healthy people subsidize the sick. We all pay the same premium. And the person who uses a lot of medical care is subsidized by somebody who never uses any medical care. when you raise that deductible to $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, and you have that individual who is chronically ill year after year, they're never going to be able to save up enough money in their health savings account. That's going to go to zero every year, and they're going to pay that deductible year after year. So we're really, in my view, on the verge of shifting costs to sicker patients and getting away from some of the things we know work, and that is managing chronic illness. And I think it's not an answer to say we're going to have a consumer-driven system and it's the responsibility of individuals and that's it. There are a lot of people that can't help when they get sick.
So in that system, how do you create the money that's supposed to be in your health account, your health bank account?
Your health savings account can be funded by your employer. And some employers are doing this and they like it because for them, it seems much as managed care did many years ago, that they're going to save money and they're going to be able to limit their health care contribution. I'm not sure in the long run how much this is going to save costs. And there are a lot of employers that won't fully fund that health savings account. And when you sort of look at this consumer-driven healthcare revolution, it's already stalling. You know, it just got here and already it's having some trouble. Satisfaction isn't that good with it. Enrollment has really slowed down. And so I guess the question is, if we exhaust managed care and we try that and that hasn't worked, and we exhaust consumer-driven healthcare and that doesn't work, and the question is, what's next? And I would like the answer to be universal coverage. I'm not sure it's going to be.
Who's behind the consumer-driven healthcare movement?
Conservatives tend to support consumer-driven healthcare, and they believe, as do a fair number of health economists, that the reason that healthcare costs are too high in the United States is people consume too much medical care and use too much medical care of too little value. In other words, they believe we actually have too much health insurance, which is a remarkable thing to say in a country where 45 million uninsured. But their belief is if you move to high deductible plans, people will think twice before they go to the doctor for unnecessary medical care. So for instance, when I get a sore throat, instead of bothering my family physician, maybe I'll have a cup of tea at home and that'll save the system money. And so the philosophy is if you feel it in your wallet and in your own bank account, you're less likely to overuse the system.
What is President Bush proposing?
President Bush actually has an interesting proposal to change the tax system. One of the sort of dirty little secrets of American health policy is that the employer-sponsored system is heavily subsidized by the federal government. When I get health insurance, in my case from the University of North Carolina, I don't pay any taxes on that. I don't pay any income taxes on what they contribute to my health insurance. I don't pay any payroll taxes. And neither does anybody else who gets employer-sponsored health insurance. And the government forgoes about $200 billion a year in tax subsidies through that. It's a very, very expensive subsidy. It's very regressive because it's worth a lot more to people in upper-income brackets than it is to people who don't pay a lot of taxes. A lot of economists would tell you that it's inefficient because it encourages overly generous insurance policies. What President Bush has proposed is to get rid of that system and to substitute a standard deduction for health insurance that anybody buying health insurance could take, whether you buy it in the individual market or you get it from your employer. And the standard deduction would be $15,000 for family insurance and I believe $7,500 for an individual. And the goal is both to make insurance more accessible and hope that some people now who can afford to buy it but don't will now have a financial incentive to purchase health insurance on the individual market. And another goal is actually to slow down healthcare spending. I actually don't think the political chances of this are very good because while most people don't understand that the system is subsidized, if you change that tax subsidy and you start taking that tax subsidy away, I think people will learn about this really fast. And while President Bush isn't up for re-election in 2008, 468 members of Congress are. And I'm not advising any of them, but if I was, I don't think I would tell them that a very good way to run for re-election is to say to your middle-class constituents, I've got a great solution to the healthcare crisis. I'm going to tax your private insurance.
During Bill Clinton's presidency, Hillary headed up the effort for healthcare reform. And that effort failed. And I wonder what lessons you think other politicians and healthcare experts took away from that failure.
You know, I think the Clinton plan failed for a lot of reasons, but I think centrally they were really guilty of the sin of ambition. They tried to do a lot of things at once. They tried to achieve universal coverage. They tried to have an employer mandate where every employer would have to offer health insurance. They tried to control costs and set limits on how much we spend on medical care in the United States. And I think most critically, they tried to change the delivery system and move it towards managed care. And one of the central reasons that they failed, and one of the challenges for all health reformers, is they alienated people who already had health insurance, who might have said, well, this is great, you want to cover the uninsured, but why are you changing my health insurance? I like my doctor. I don't want to change my health insurance. I don't want to join an HMO. I think if you look at the proposals that some of the candidates have put out right now, one of the things you notice right away is they're really building on the existing system we have. They're trying to leave people who have good insurance alone and, in fact, trying to make that insurance more secure. But they don't want to try and change the delivery system. I think the other lesson, which is really very interesting, is you don't see a lot of cost control in the plans that are coming out right now. Because one of the things that killed the Clinton plan is they threatened the income of the insurance industry, of medical care providers, of really the whole healthcare system. And so when you look at these candidates' plans, they'll talk a lot about saving money through information technology and administrative savings, and there's some truth in that. But they're really not talking about hard cost controls because politically, I think they just don't want to go there.
How does it feel for you as a healthcare policy expert to feel that the system is really failing, and yet fixing it is going to be so improbable because of all of the political obstacles?
Feels really bad. It feels like Groundhog Day. Remember the movie where Bill Murray wakes up to the same day over and over again? And I started studying healthcare policy myself 20 years ago. And sometimes my students today ask me, what's changed in the system? And what I tell them is nothing. Absolutely nothing has changed. And really, the problems that we have now, high costs, not great quality of care, huge uninsured population, those are the same problems that I learned about 20 years ago, except that all of them are worse. So it is dispiriting. The one good thing that I can take away from this is we are seeing some real movement at the state level. And I think if you look at places like Massachusetts, and if you look at states like California, and you see that you have Republican governors and Democratic legislatures coming together to adopt reforms, then maybe there is some hope for change.
Take one of those states and tell us what you find optimistic about the actual reforms.
Well, I think the case in Massachusetts is very interesting. They tried health reform there before in the late 1980s, and it didn't work out. And they're back at it. And the reform that they have passed is a sort of combination reform that builds on the existing system and expands Medicaid and makes available subsidized private insurance through a purchasing pool, and also mandates that people who can afford to buy health insurance have to buy it. And what I think is interesting about that program politically is it was supported by Governor Romney, although he's sort of running away from it right now. But when he was governor in Massachusetts, he was behind it and the Democratic legislature was behind it. So it's an interesting bipartisan combination. And I think it's a pretty good package. Is it going to get them the universal coverage? I don't think so. But they have already insured over 100,000 residents in Massachusetts who did not have health insurance. So they're really right now leading the pack among American states. There are a bunch of other states that are talking about doing things, but Massachusetts is really out ahead of them at the moment.
Well, Jonathan Oberlander, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jonathan Oberlander is an associate professor of social medicine and health policy and administration at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new box set collecting recordings from the 1930s featuring tenor saxophonist Chu Berry. This is Fresh Air. Tenor saxophonist Leon Barry, who was nicknamed Chew, died at age 33 in a 1941 accident, ending a 9-year run in recording studios that found him backing singers like Billie Holiday and Mildred Bailey, jamming in informal sessions, squeezing short solos into big band numbers by Fletcher Henderson or Cab Calloway, and getting a few featured numbers all to himself. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Chew Barry box set that details his meteoric career.
I had a nightmare last night when I lay down. When I woke up this morning, my sweet man couldn't be found. I'm going down to the river. Into it I'm going to jump. Can't keep
Chew Berry in dialogue with blues queen Bessie Smith in 1933. It was her last recording session, and one of his first. The 1920 scene Smith had dominated was already starting to look like ancient history as the swing era loomed. Jazz was evolving so quickly, young musicians needed to master an already established language and keep abreast of new developments, which placed more demands on soloists. Players learned by imitating the masters, even as they strove to define their own sound. Barry wasn't shy about challenging tenor sax champ Coleman Hawkins, his role model for improvising busy lines that elegantly outline a tune's chords. They became sort of friendly rivals. Hawk improvised prettier phrases, but Barry had his own leathery tone, slinky lines, and jumpier timing. Barry with Lionel Hampton, 1939. The tenor saxophonist is subject of a new 7-CD box from the web order house Mosaic Records, classic Chew Barry, Columbia, and Victor sessions. It gives you almost as detailed a survey of his recording career as one could ask for, lacking only a few essentials. An outgoing, outspoken musician from West Virginia, Barry sparked the big bands he played in, urging his colleagues to try harder and aim higher. He gave bandleader Fletcher Henderson one of his big hits with Christopher Columbus, built on a pet Barry riff. He had even greater impact after he joined the chronically underrated singer Cab Calloway, encouraging Cab to feature the band more on hipper arrangements. Calloway, for his part, was a sterling showman who made field hollering hip for hipsters. His songs celebrated looking sharp and living large, even if hearty partying might lead to a breach in social decorum.
Late this morning, about 10:30, old Pops come falling in, lipstick on his cheek and a knot on his chin, no hat, no shoes, but a belly full of gin. Uncle, auntie, he still got on his panty. Oh, Pop's in bed with his britches on. Pop's in bed with his britches on.
Mm-hmm.
On record, Chew Berry is so often glimpsed in short 8 or 16 bar bursts, you get impatient to hear him hog the spotlight. In 1940, Calloway showcased him on A Ghost of a Chance, where Berry borrows a lick or two and the general atmosphere from Coleman Hawkins' recent hit Body and Soul. That record had pointedly bested Berry's version from the year before. By 1941, Chew Berry had been picking up ideas from young mavericks like trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie and jamming with them on the Harlem after-hours sessions that gave rise to a new style, soon known as bebop. Berry wouldn't live to see it through, though. He was on the road with Cab Calloway when fatally injured in a car crash in Ohio. But the dozens of sessions he'd recorded staked his claim as one of the great soloists of the 1930s. By the way, shortly before Berry died, his perennial rival Coleman Hawkins was asked to list his favorite tenor players. Chew Berry came in at number 2.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed classic Chew Berry, Columbia, and Victor sessions on the Mosaic label. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the independent film Sweet Land, starring Elizabeth Reaser and Tim Guinea, on DVD July 10th. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable, on the web at grdodge.org. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Okay, so your brain on drugs isn't anything like a fried egg, but what is going on in the addicted brain? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. Nora Volkoff, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Her research has helped demonstrate that addiction is a disease of the brain. Join us for the next Fresh Air.